So thank you all so much for coming. This is part of TBAVJ's mission. We have regularly held public forums on issues of consequence that involve race and media and society, and certainly the Trayvon Martin situation, his death, and the trial of George Zimmerman on murder charges are no exception. This is an incident that has galvanized the world for more than a year. It's had hordes of media descend on Sanford, Florida for weeks at a time, months at a time. And many of us in the newspaper industry, in the media industry, in the news media industry, have tried hard to make sense of this and cut through some of the misinformation that's out there and get at the facts and try to have to quote a certain out, a fair and balanced conversation about this. So I appreciate you coming, and that's something that we're going to try to do here today. Before we start, I'm going to give you a little plug of my own, which is for my book called Race Baiter. I have a few copies of it here, and in the first chapter of Race Baiter, I talk about how the media initially covered the death of Trayvon Martin, and how its initial reaction and then the later reaction of the media over the first month after his death sort of reveals how prejudice and stereotypes work in media. So a lot of what we're going to talk about tonight, I kind of discussed in the book, so if you're interested in exploring it further, feel free to come up. I'll be happy to sign a copy for you, and we can do all that after this is all over. So let's meet our panelists. First, to my left, we have Corey Person, president of the George Edgecombe Bar Association. Next to him, we have Alec Hall, a federal public defender. Next to Alec, we have Joe Camino.
I say Camino.
Camino.
Nothing a book can't take care of.
He's a criminal defense attorney and the only Tampa resident who was on the Governor Scott's State of the Ground committee. Carolyn Collins, the head of the Hillsborough County NAACP. And then next to Carolyn is Ben Montgomery, stalwart reporter from the Tampa Bay Times, who covered the George Zimmerman trial for us. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask a lot of questions of our panel and try to get some discussion going on myself. And after we've had some of that discussion, we'll take questions from the crowd. And I always say it when we have these forums, and it always falls on deaf ears, but I'm going to say it again. Here's taking questions, not statements, not speeches, not polemics. We want questions because we have the experts over here, and we want to find out what you have questions about and make sure that you get answers. And we also want to connect you to media figures in town. So if you have questions about how this is covered, if you want to impact Tampa Bay Times or Florida Courier or some of the other news outlets that TBAVJ members work at, please approach us either during this panel or afterwards, and we'd be happy to do what we can to affect better coverage. So the first question I have is a pretty simple one, and I want to start with Corey and just kind of go across the panel. Were you surprised by the verdict that exonerated George Zimmerman, and did you agree with him?
Okay, first question. I was not surprised. I thought, having looked at different aspects of the trial, I've watched the whole thing, but certainly kept up with it with the evening news and the show, different parts of it, reading about it, trial and on. I think I had concerns throughout the course of the trial that the prosecution was going to have a difficult time meeting the high threshold of reasonable doubt, getting over reasonable doubt in the murder. And so I was certainly not surprised with the verdict. I thought it was very likely that the jury would come back with a verdict of not guilty for him based on that. As an officer of the court, I respect the rule of law and I accept the verdict that was handed down. I mean, we don't know, none of us were in the jury room with their deliberations or know exactly what they considered and all the information that they considered. And I don't know, very few of us probably have a really good grasp of all the evidence that was presented during the course of the trial. And so I just think that, you know, the backdrop, there were just so many other factors and things that we learned through the media, through the coverage of the trial, that really informed some of our opinions about the case. I think in absence of some of those other factors, the race factors, things of that nature, that, you know, this was simply a case that had come down to the evidence and whether the prosecution met its burden. So I was not surprised by the verdict.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Hall, what do you think? Were you surprised?
I wasn't surprised. I've been practicing a little over 15 years, criminal defense, state and federal. Juries scare me.
Why do juries scare you?
Well, you just never know what a jury is going to do, certainly in a criminal case. Certainly in an ideal situation, a prosecutor would like to have a slam dunk case. You got fingerprints, you got eyewitnesses, and you have what we call a third witness. You have a videotape, things of that nature. But in this case, you didn't have that, and you only had really one version of events. And then having sat and watched some of the trial, because I do work, and then seeing the highlights at the end of the day, watching Anderson Cooper and the other talk shows as well, and seeing some of the witnesses, their demeanor, presentation of the evidence, led me to believe that a not guilty verdict was going to be imminent. Now, I did think to a certain degree that the jury probably would have come back with a manslaughter because you did have a dead person here, and all of this could have been avoided. But at the end of the day, the presentation of the government's case, they didn't arrest Mrs. Zimmerman right away, and I think there was a reason for that. So I really wasn't surprised with it. Did I agree with it? As Corey indicated, as an officer of the court, we respect the jury decision. That's what we call justice or proof. But I was just disappointed because I think it sent the wrong message at the end of the day, whether you was on either side of the fence. I think at the end of the day, it just sent the wrong message because we didn't need a division amongst the races for such a verdict, but nevertheless, that was the jury verdict.
Joe, do you think Stand Your Ground laws had any impact on this verdict, and were you surprised by it?
I didn't get to answer the first question.
You didn't answer any question you
want. Let me just say I was able, like Alec, to watch some of the trial and listen to a lot of it through the phone, through streaming, but I was not surprised by the verdict from a legal standpoint, just based on the burden of proof. And also, I thought there was a lot that of emphasis on the presentation, I thought, of the prosecution's case. I was able to see that. I don't think that it was there beyond and to the exclusion of a reasonable doubt. But also, like Alec, I would have. I remember going outside with my wife to walk the dog, and we heard the verdict was coming back in 15 minutes, and we both thought it was going to be a manslaughter verdict because we both felt like even the state had not proven beyond reasonable doubt second-degree murder. They had shown some evidence that it was some type of reckless disregard for him to approach somebody with a firearm that he didn't know in the middle of the night. So I would have agreed with that verdict, but I also agreed with the not guilty. I could have seen either one. But from what I heard the jurors say that spoke, they didn't really sound like they put too much emphasis on the no duty to retreat language in the jury instructions. I did hear one juror kind of say it in passing. You know, we didn't know what to do. It was the law said we had to do this. You know, and she just said stand your ground. You know, and that. But it didn't sound like they put too much emphasis in it. But I would like to hear from the others and see if it did.
So what's interesting to me now, we've had three lawyers basically say they weren't surprised by the verdict, but I've heard so many people say that they were. So Dr. Collins, were you surprised by the verdict? Are you surprised that they weren't surprised?
Yes, I was surprised by the verdict. No, I'm not surprised that they were not surprised because they have a level of knowledge from the law that I do not have. However, I got to say it the way. No, I was not surprised. But I was surprised by the verdict itself. The main reason was I actually assumed that if I saw the situation where Marissa had been arrested and given 20 years for shooting in the ceiling and not killing anyone, and someone who had disregarded the rules and regulations of the homeowners association, had a gun on his person, followed a young man that he was told not to follow, I just assumed that you just have to be guilty for that. And there's no way to be not guilty. So, yes, I was surprised by the verdict because I thought the verdict was biased. And I do not think that a jury of Mr. Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin Pierce would have come up with that same verdict. That being said, I need to say that I have so many individuals, and I have to say this in the area of education, that said to me, an all-white women jury, maybe one that was not, but a female jury with a black male. So they somewhat felt that that may happen anyway. When it come down to did I agree with it, same thing. No, yeah. I did not.
So you're saying you felt that you had other people telling you that a jury with mostly white women would feel that a black male was threatening, that they would resonate, that argument would resonate with them?
We had quite a few discussions with some educators, and basically we go on the premise that we all know that a third grader in school determines the prison beds in this country. And if you look at the demeanor and some of the things that happen with African-American males in school, despite their size, they start having trouble. And that was part of the discussion that we had with a number of individuals, that indeed might not work well for Trayvon Martin with the female jurors.
So now we come to Ben. Now, I was following Ben's Twitter feed during the whole trial, and I got to say, especially during jury selection, I was feeling for you. that can be tedious. But in the end, the verdict seemed to come pretty quickly and almost out of nowhere. I mean, people were not expecting the deliberations to end that quickly. So tell me, were you surprised, and what do you think about that?
I was so unsurprised that I actually typed Zimmerman is not guilty into my Twitter feed and hovered over the send button so that I, you know, was quick with it. I mean, it wasn't a surprise at all to me. And it wasn't a surprise primarily because of the jury instruction, primarily because the prosecution did not prove ill intent in anybody's mind. And this law, the instructions that they're given, the senior ground law, I felt very easily protected this gentleman against the crime that he was charged with. And soon after the verdict came, as you know, things flared out outside the courthouse, I tweeted something to the effect of, if you're angry about this verdict, perhaps your energy is best directed at changing the law that protects people who use deadly force in situations like this. I don't think there's any question about that. So, no, I wasn't surprised at all. You mentioned jury selection, by the way. Can I stress that? This was the surprise of the century for me because it's the first time I've been involved in a trial of this nature, this big, with this much attention on it. And if any of you watched jury selection, you came quickly to learn that there was a pool of about 500 Seminole County residents. And they were all given a questionnaire right off the bat. And that questionnaire eliminated off the top of that pool of 500 the busiest, most engaged, connected people. Then through the questioning of the remaining 100 or so, attorneys asked, you know, things like, have you ever heard of George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin? And if the answer was yes, it was less likely that person's vote was going to be picked for the jury. So we're talking about people who live within 10 miles of where this incident happened and all of the media coverage swarming around all of this. And we wound up with six people who were almost completely unaware of anything that happened. So these are people who don't engage with television news, don't engage with the newspaper, don't even necessarily, I would think, engage with communication with their peers who might be talking about this. So I wrote about this, but it struck me that in these high-profile trials that don't change venue, you wind up with, this sounds pejorative, but like info hermits, people who choose not to connect with the outside world, and are those the kinds of people we want weighing the facts of a complicated case such as this? I'm not sure.
I mean, that's, you know, what's interesting to me about this is that what you say is true, but we've also got three attorneys who said that the prosecution didn't prove its case. So does that really make a difference? I guess is the question.
Great question. I'd love to hear them talk about jury selection.
Can you, Alec, can you talk to me a little bit about, you're the one who first expressed some misgivings about a jury.
Right.
And when this verdict came down, a lot of people like Dr. Collins said, well, this just means the jury system is terrible.
Right.
And that these people were ignorant and they made the wrong decision.
Right. But before we do that, can I ask them a follow-up question?
Yes, sir.
You were talking about the pool of jurors. I think you indicated that there were about 500.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to refer to it as the pool.
Sure.
When I say the pool, that's everyone that's been summoned
right. For
the attorneys to pick from. I think you said 500. Can you tell us how many in that pool of 500 were African-American?
I don't know.
Roughly.
We weren't privy to that. I don't know.
You didn't get a chance to see the people in the jury selection process?
Out of the pool of 100, I don't think they went all the way through the 100 that were remaining after the 400 had been dismissed. Just a ballpark guess, 10% of the remaining were African
American. Now, did you hear what he said? So let's say of 100, you only had 10%, you only had 10. Now, the way the jury selection works, at least in federal court, let's say 1 through 100. Now, can you tell us what was that 10 in position of that 100? So, in other words, were they toward the front or were they toward the back, toward the middle? Because, as I understand it, they were talking about jury selection was going to take several days, but it took a lot quicker than that. So, let's say in Florida, this is not a capital case. So, for those who are wondering, why was there only 6, not 12? Well, you only get 12 in the capital case. This is not a capital case, so you only had 6. So how many do you need for the jury? You only need 6. You're going to pick alternates. Well, if you're picking 6, let's say 8, they went with 10. So the rest of the 90, they're toward the back. And if you don't have African-Americans toward the front, you're not going to have African-Americans more than likely sitting on the jury pool. Now, I do want to say what the late Johnny Cochran said after the O.J. Simpson trial. He said African-Americans, and I agree with this, will convict another African-American in a heartbeat. They will convict another African-American before anybody else will. So I want that to be clear. But for me, on an issue like this, this is something that I think African-Americans are going to be more sensitive to, and they're going to be drawing a lot more questions to what was going on out there when we listen to Juror B37 and some of the comments she made. Those are issues that certainly resonate with African-Americans more so than those of non-color. So it's a cultural thing. But you asked about jury selection. So you have what's called challenges for cause. The person says they can't follow the law. They believe marijuana should be legal if it was a drug case. Well, that person not going to follow the law. Judge, I don't care what you tell me. I'm not going to follow that. Okay, that's a for cause. That person cannot follow the jury instructions. So that's what we have, for cause. And then we have what's called peremptory strikes. Peremptory strikes, you have so many strikes. In federal court, I use that as an example. I had 10 strikes. Joe, if he's a prosecutor, just let me use it for a minute, Joe. He has 6 strikes. And the judge, we'll go back and forth until we even them out. I get to use my 10 peremptory strikes however I want to. With the exception, I cannot strike someone based on a constitutional protected class, race, or gender. So if I'm picking right here, and I come to the lady right here, and I strike, let's say Joe strikes her. Well, I'll say to the judge, I'll raise a Batson versus Kentucky challenge. U.S. Supreme Court case which says that you can't strike someone because of race or gender. Then the burden's on Joe to come back and say, well, judge, I'm striking this African-American because she has a husband who's a police officer or whatever the case may be. That wouldn't be him saying that, but I'm just using it as an example. And if the judge agrees with that, she stays. If Joe says, well, judge, I'm going to strike her because, she has a 6th grade education. Okay, he may say, well, I'm not going to grant that. And so he will not get the chance to strike her. So that's how peremptory strikes work. Now, this is a strategy. And let me say this. When you're in trial, this is the Super Bowl. This is game 7. We're not playing checkers. We're playing chess now. There is no tomorrow. We're here to win. And so we have to keep that in mind. So this is strategy going back and forth. I'm asking questions to the extent I get a chance to conduct voir dire, ask questions of the juror. I'm pushing my theory. I want someone on my jury that's going to be sympathetic towards my client. So that's how jury selection works. You go back and forth and you pick someone that's going to be advantageous, whether it's for the state or for the defense. That's who you want to sit on your jury. I'm just surprised that the prosecution, and I don't mean to play Monday morning armchair quarterback, I'm just surprised that the jury was picked that quickly. I don't know what type of questions. In any case, you're floating your theory of the case, your theory of defense on, as defense attorneys Joe and I, we're floating our theory of the case. Certainly in state court, you get a chance to ask questions. Generally, I'm asking questions. So I'm just really surprised that the jury was picked that quickly, and I'd be curious to know what questions were asked of the pool by the prosecution.
Right. Sure. I don't practice criminal law like Alex, so I'm glad that he's sitting right here next to me. But I'm a civil trial lawyer, and much of the process and what Alex just described is very much the same on the civil side as it is on the criminal side. Picking a jury is a science. It's not an exact science, but it's a science. And the strategy for the trial will even begin before that with motions, but once you get there, like he said, it's game seven. You're implementing your strategy for how you want this trial to turn out. And that goes to the very heart of who you want on that jury, whether it's a civil case or a criminal case. But we have to understand that what makes our jury system so strong is also what makes it so weak, is that people come to the jury and people sitting on the jury come with their experiences, their education, their history, their influences, and they're sitting there with all that. Now, typically, in a system like we have direct jurisprudence, that's the best way to ensure that you're going to get at least some fairness across the board. But we have to also understand that that's going to also create gross inconsistencies, because one jury pool is going to make a very different decision, perhaps, than another jury pool, and it's because they are informed by their life experiences and what they bring to the table. Like Ben was saying, I mean, this particular group appeared to be, based on the questionnaires, a group that was not very informed, was not very involved in current affairs, and what was going on in the community and outside. And so they probably had a very limited experience in terms of, well, you know, why would this gentleman perhaps be pursuing this young male in this community? Could race have played a factor in that? Those are the kinds of things that perhaps if you had an African-American jury would understand quickly some basis. Why this gentleman would be pursuing this unarmed African-American child in this community. So those are the kinds of things we have to understand. When we look at juries, and we look at, well, this decision ended up with this kind of verdict and this kind of sentence and this decision didn't, is that you're going to end up with some of those inconsistencies because we have a jury system in American jurisprudence.
Corey, I would push back just a little bit and say the judge excluded mention of racial profile, right? So how can you expect the jury to consider it if the judge has already said something to it?
Lawyers say stuff, and we have a term, cat out of the bag in the trial, because that's sometimes a lawyer, you even want to say something that you know is going to be excluded, that the judge is going to give an instant instruction that you must exclude that. And the jury's heard it, and they're going to consider it, and they're going to think about it. And the reason Alex's initial statement, jury scary, because when they go back there, perhaps the law is what they apply, but oftentimes, certainly in civil cases, we know that, do I like this plaintiff? Mm-hmm. Do I like this defendant? Do I get a good feeling about this person? Mm-hmm. Did I find that witness credible? And so those are a lot of the things. They're human. It's the same human things that we deal with. You know, how do I feel? What's my gut telling me? You know, they're not lawyers. They're not looking at the application alone. That's why lawyers up here weren't surprised by the verdict. Emotionally, when you look at it emotionally, you may be surprised by the verdict. You say, well, wait a minute, I've got a dead child here, and he was unarmed, and the police had a lawful right to be. But in juries oftentimes will have an emotional and not always looking at the legal nuts and bolts of it and making their decision.
So, Joe, a lot of people have used this as an opportunity to talk about standing ground, particularly because it was included as part of the jury instruction. So do you think standing ground played a part in this verdict? And if so, what part did it play?
I can't pretend to say that I know, because we've only heard from one or two of the jurors. And from what I heard them say, it just seemed like they mentioned it in passing. And so I can't say whether or not it did for sure. But like Ben is saying, you know, he was there. He listened to the jury instructions as they were read, and I guess as they were arguing by the
by the defense attorneys and the prosecution. I didn't get to see the closing arguments. So I would kind of defer to Ben as to how the defense, how much focus they put on that, the no duty to retreat language of the jury instructions. But I did want to mention something about when we were talking about jurors, is I think some of the issues that were present in the case is that, as I watched it, I didn't hear anything really about Trayvon Martin, in the sense that I didn't feel like the prosecution really developed who the young man was. And all I heard during the whole trial was who George Zimmerman was, or Georgie, and all that stuff. And I don't necessarily know why that was. I don't know if they felt like they'd be opening the door to the pictures that were found on the phone.
That's what I said.
But I think that was a fatal flaw in the presentation. I think it goes back to what's the presentation that was given to those jurors who, like Ben said, are info hermits and don't pay attention to a lot of TV or read a lot of newspapers and things like that. I just don't think that it was presented to them in a manner that they were able to actually resonate with the person who was killed, and more so they did, I thought, with the defendant in the case.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't really get to answer your question.
No, that's great. So you served on this task force that took a look at Standing Your Ground. And the task force eventually determined that it didn't need to be revamped, right?
Well, I brought the report that has the recommendations on it. There was a report that had the core recommendations that was given to Governor Scott. So there were a lot of things that I thought that we made recommendations to clarify certain parts of the statute, whether in defining certain areas of the statute, and whether it should apply in certain scenarios or not.
But the idea of repealing it was rejected.
There was no sentiment really from when we set out, and I just want to kind of go back a little bit. Well, our instructions were to listen to people in 8 or 9 different cities through the course of a year. It wasn't really having dialogue with people. I just met with Art this afternoon or this evening, and he was at 3 of them, I think he said. And I think I do remember him now that I got a chance to talk to him. But it was everyone got 3 minutes to speak on what their opinion was, and we listened to the opinions and the presentations that were given, and at the conclusion of the meetings, make recommendations based on what was presented by the people. And there wasn't an overall sentiment that repealing the statute was necessary. What I felt the sentiment was from people was that everyone agreed with the right to defend yourself, but there were a lot of people whose family members were killed and were unhappy that one person got to make the decision that an arrest was not going to be made, or that that they were not going to be prosecuted, and they felt like that sort of process was unfair. So,
what I've heard critics say is that the law itself discourages police officers from arresting people who are involved in these situations, because they have to be certain that they have a level of probable cause that might be higher than if the law didn't exist, and it also allows people to claim that they felt threatened by someone, and as we all know, people find black males threatening for reasons that they may not have control over, so they're skin color. And so there's a concern that those two conditions together create a situation where people can invoke state of ground after they unfairly use legal force to end the confrontation. Did you guys talk about that at all? Did you address sort of the concerns of the racial element of the law? And where did that come out in what you guys were talking about?
We addressed it, and it came right in the beginning when one of the sheriffs that was on the panel just wasn't clear on whether he could make an arrest or couldn't make an arrest on any situation, and that he had to be told by the prosecutor of his county whether or not he could make an arrest. And that's just not the case. So there was an overwhelming presentation throughout the meetings that law enforcement was unclear as to what was needed to make an arrest. And it seems that county by county, there's going to be some decisions that are made based on who's investigating the case, whether a person should be arrested. And that's where I think you get the unfair decision makings and the inconsistent decisions.
Yeah, Is that going to be addressed at all? Is there any chance that might change?
I think we made the recommendation that it should be addressed, more education and making sure that there's some sort of review and training for people to make more objective and informed decisions. But none of that was addressed at the session.
So, Dr. Collins, I'm sure the NAACP has been involved with this issue. You talked a little bit about Marissa Alexander, who is a woman from Jacksonville, who is serving a 20-year sentence now because she shot at an abusive husband, and a prosecutor concluded that she was shooting at him and not firing a warning shot as she planned. Now, the prosecutor has said that she fired and hit a door jamb, sort of in the middle of the door jamb, that she didn't fire into the ceiling, and that they concluded that because she had gone to a garage and come back with a weapon, fired at him instead of in the air, and that there were kids in an adjoining room, that she was trying to harm him, and it was not a case of staying the ground. So what do you think about that, now that you hear those elements of what the prosecutor says, and how does this all fit into the staying the ground debate?
Stand your ground debate that was passed, and I thought for sure that the task force would look at that. I think that any law that's passed for any reason should be evaluated at some point. And according to, not me, but according to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, the 2000 to 2005 stand your ground self-defense, not stand your ground self-defense laws did not exceed 40 in the state of Florida. After Stand Your Ground was passed, it was nearly a 300% increase in the use of that case. Usually when you're doing research and you're studying and you're looking for safety and trying to improve the environment, if something goes awry, you want to usually kind of modify and change it. So I was hoping that the focus of the governor's task force would be to have individuals there that would take a look at a law that was changing a law we already had on the book to make it more restrictive. There was a statement, and I want to make sure I get it right. I really want to read it, just like we did in our resolution. I don't want to kind of come away from it at all. But it simply says that on October the 1st, 2005, Florida became the first state in the union to pass the Personal Protection Bill, which greatly expand and the lawyers can ask about this because I'm not a lawyer, the Castle Doctrine, eliminating the requirement to retreat in cases of defending one's own house against an intruder, which has now come to be known as the Stand Your Ground. Mr. Zimmerman, or Georgie, because that bothered me with the juror who began to say Georgie, so I'm not too convinced about her being what you said, the hermit. Because she was certainly comfortable with Georgie. I just cannot understand why. And I'm at a disadvantage. I was in the state legislature when there was argument, doing a visit to Tallahassee. And when the group that I was with decided to leave, I wanted to see the vote. Because it was really dumb examples that were being given by our state legislators. And they were dumb. Because someone described a newspaper in their front yard, they go out to get their newspaper, and if someone was out in the front yard and trying to take their newspaper, if they went and got their gun or they had their gun, they could shoot them, and if they shoot them, they no longer had to drag them in their home. That it was self-defense. So I had a real problem, and I sat there and waited to see the green and the yellow, the green and the red lights as they went up on the board, and I just couldn't believe, I was surprised then that it passed. So certainly I was surprised after the jury trial. But by the time we got to 2009, according to the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, what had been 32, 33, 35, 32, 31, 43, and then the law changed, dropped down to 33, it went up to 102 cases, 93 cases, and then 105. It increased. It simply justified the use of force, and we know who it was justified on. And I need to say this. It disturbed us greatly because we then went to everyone in Hillsborough County for the NAACP and we asked law enforcement locally, please tell us what's happening. let us know how many of these cases have occurred in Hillsborough County. We couldn't get anyone to respond to them, but we're very grateful that the 13th Judicial Circuit finally gave us the information from April to August, years later, and we found we had 82 cases prior to Trayvon Martin here in Hillsborough County. So we say if we had 82 prior to Trayvon, which probably was between 2011 and 2012, now how many in the state of Florida?
Right. Well, now, Ben, I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Maybe you don't know this, but the Tampa Bay Times did a series where we looked at all these danger ground cases. One of the things we found was that if you kill a black person, you're more likely to use a successful standard ground defense. But there was some complexity to that. Can you talk a little bit about that? Do you know that? That series going on.
So of the two, first of all, I should say, and RKO can speak to this. The way we came to find there's no bureaucratic system that tracks cases in which standard ground is invoked. So when we went after this newspaper, we're talking to as many prosecutors and defense attorneys as we can across the state, police chiefs across the state, searching all of the major newspapers in the state, trying to identify these cases in which standard ground has been invoked. We came up, I'm sure, well short, because there's no way we can track, it's not like you can search every court case for the phrase standard ground and see where it plays out. It's just impossible. So the 200 cases that we identified in June of last year, we found that people who killed a black person walked free 73% of the time, while those who killed a white person went free 59% of the time. That's a big deal. A couple of other facts. Whites who invoked the law were charged at the same rate as blacks. Whites who went to trial were convicted at the same rate as blacks. In mixed-race cases involving fatalities, the outcomes were similar. Four of the five blacks who killed a white went free. Five of the six whites who killed a black went free. Overall, black defendants went free 66% of the time in fatal cases compared to 61% of the time for white defendants. A difference explained in part by the fact that blacks were more likely to kill another black. So it's complicated. And in the discussion, I feel like something has sort of happened of late, and it's almost like the Facebooking of America. Like everything has become a poster, you know, where you get very nominal, small facts, and you're asked to make a judgment on a particular case just based on a little bit of info. And the fact is, criminal cases are complicated and lengthy, and there's a lot of evidence that's introduced. And I think it's a good idea for all of us to, if we're really interested in this law, instead of just relying on anecdotes to prove our point or to debate with friends or whatever, it's best to like step back and understand that these things are big and hairy and not everything fits together. And, you know, and there's all kinds of different problems that go on from jury selection to, you know, to trial to, you know, the progress, and correct me if I'm wrong, Joe, but the progress for actually the invocation of standard ground begins when a person, with the police, do police arrest a defendant based on what the evidence they have against them? If it makes it past that point, then the prosecutor, if standard ground is invoked, the prosecutor is asked then to consider that. If the prosecutor decides to press formal charges, it goes to trial. Sometimes standard ground is invoked, and the defendant is given a pretrial hearing based on standard ground. Then the judge is asked to make a decision before it ever gets to jury about whether this case should even go to jury. So there are three steps where standard ground can be and is sometimes invoked, and then it can be written into the jury instruction. So there are four different chances where people are asked to consider whether the facts of the case apply or are protected, you know, by this new law. I think some of the confusion we're seeing, it's probably the case of like a lot of new laws, I'm sure you guys can speak to this, but a lot of new criminal law, there's a period of time in which people are asked to interpret this law in courts, attorneys, etc. And we're starting to see the establishment of some case law that pertains to standard ground. Right, Joe?
Yep.
Yeah. So It seems to me that a major problem in this is interpretation. And a lot of different people are being asked to interpret this law that's probably written kind of loosely. Police, all over the state. Prosecutors, all over the state. Judges, all over the state at different levels. And then jurors, all over the state. So, so it's a big, very complicated thing.
And as complicated as it is, I'm going to try to boil it down to a simple question, and I'll ask that to Corey. Because I think what a lot of people want to know, are black people disproportionately and unfairly affected by state and rent? And why can't someone answer that question directly?
Excuse me.
Well, unfortunately, I don't necessarily have an answer to that question, whether or not they're disproportionately affected. I think I just listened to some of the statistics that Ben read. Based on what he just read, it appears that it seems to have a consistent application across the board. I think we all know, just in the criminal justice system, African Americans are disproportionately affected. The challenge is, and like we're talking about a little bit, any law that's starting to get wheels on it, and is then you can have a chance to examine it, to go through the legal process as implemented or as prosecuted. In this case, give some insight into the areas of that law that might need to be modified, that might need to be changed, that might need a second look. The biggest difficulty I have with this law in particular is that it does not carve out an exception for a person who initiates the contact, who initiates the confrontation. So it allows a person to initiate a confrontation but still rely on the law as a defense, even though it didn't, in the legal case here, Zimmerman didn't use that as a defense. The other part that's challenging, as we talked about a little bit, is that police aren't sure about what to do with this all the time. And I think, and Alec, you can let me know if I'm way off base here, but certainly in the case we have a homicide or murder investigation, rather, that initial, how the police handle that initially, there's a show on TV called 48 Hours, it's mesmerizing. But how the police initiate
the first
48 hours. As the most important time you're dealing with a murder investigation, how are you going to treat that? Because you got to get to witnesses. You got to collect all the important evidence, because beyond that time, you run a greater risk of losing that. And so police aren't treating something like this, unarmed teenager in a place he had a lawful right to be, and then another individual who's armed with a weapon and disregarded directly not to approach the individual. Coming up onto that scene, I think, but for the law, perhaps, the police treat that very differently. Material, and that has a material effect on every aspect of the case from that point forward. Just like any time you start something, sometimes how you start impacts how you finish. So I think, that's a challenge with this case. Like I said, I'm a civil lawyer, not a criminal lawyer, but in civil law, certain types of cases, particularly discrimination cases, you have two types that you look at. One is what's called a disparate treatment provision, which is, did this particular law, this particular practice affect this individual wrongly, and if so, was it discriminatory? But then you have a disparate effect, which is we look across the board, and although the law is, plain on its face, it's not discriminatory on its face, but it's having a disparate impact on a particular class of people, African Americans, women. So I think if you're looking at a law like this, if you're seeing that there's a disparate impact, then it should trigger something to say, well, wait a minute, why is it having this disparate impact? Because the law on its face, when you look at it, doesn't have anything about race in it. So it's not, if it's applied equally across the board, it should have an equal effect everywhere. But if it's having a disparate impact, then you have to look at it, examine the reasons why, and then look at how can we modify this, how can we amend it, how can we get it better. The great thing about laws that they can be amended. They can be interpreted by the courts and they are amended by the legislature. So, those are the issues that the challenge I think that this law presents.
Yeah, I have to say I'm kind of surprised and concerned that there isn't a mechanism to track these cases officially. Seems to me that at the very least we want to know how this law is impacting criminal cases. For example, we don't know how many times a police officer decided not to arrest someone simply because of the state ground law. Even if we went back, even though the Tampa Bay Times tried to go back and track this stuff, there's no way to know if people didn't charge people because of the law. Joe, you got something to add?
Yeah, I just want to make a comment. Based on what Ms. Collins and Corey said, I think that as a criminal defense attorney, it is discouraging when you see that certain juries will find, depending on who the defendant is, against the defendant or for the defendant on a case that you think they probably should have found them guilty or not guilty. It's very discouraging to see, to go in front of one judge and see an outcome in front of that judge, and then you go down the hall into another courtroom, same similar case or the same type of fact pattern, and you see a different outcome. It's just discouraging, and that's why I think Alec is saying he's scared of juries. But I do want to make a comment on something that Corey just touched upon. With respect to this self-defense law, Chapter 776, and the jury instructions that the jurors get, there is an instruction and there is part of the statute that specifically addresses when the person that's accused is the initial aggressor. And specifically, I'll just read it, the justifications given where there's no duty to retreat in the self-defense law, it says that those justifications, and this is Chapter 776.041, use of force by the aggressor. And it says that the justification described in those preceding sections of this chapter is not available. In other words, they're not allowed to use it as a defense. You can't find a person not guilty. To a person who, and there's one where it says the person is attempting to commit or is committing or escaping after the commission of a forcible felony. The second one is if the person is a person who initially provokes the use of force against himself or herself. So there's some misunderstanding or misinformation that's out there that there isn't something carved out where the person who initially provokes the circumstance can't use self-defense. There is a specific instruction that they get. And I'll tell you this. It's that defendant's burden to show if there is evidence that he initially provoked the circumstance, it's their burden to show that the force that was ultimately used was reasonable because he or she was in fear of death or great bodily harm. So I think in this case, the Zimmerman case and Trayvon Martin case, that's why they didn't use a immunity motion, is because it would have been incumbent upon them, because the evidence showed, I think everybody in this room would agree, that Zimmerman initiated or provoked the confrontation. So it would have been his burden to show, for immunity to apply, that the force that he used was reasonable. And there's just, you know, probably no way that a judge is going to grant that motion. And that's the instruction they were given. That's the law. So I know we're all talking about this amendment to the law, but this is part of the amendment.
I will point out that if you believe Zimmerman's account, he didn't initiate the fight.
Yeah. He
claims that when the police dispatcher told him, "We don't need you to follow him," that he went back to his car and Trayvon came up to him and started the fight.
So then why you put that in evidence if you're in the state? You know, they should have just let Zimmerman testify to that or present that. And again, it goes back to the presentation of the state's case. But
go ahead, Ben.
Thanks.
I want, before you start talking, we're going to start taking some questions from the crowd. So I'm going to just ask a couple questions and then we'll go to you guys. So if you start lining up here, we'll take one of these wireless mics and we'll have somebody from TABJ who would like to come up and help hold the mic and allow you to ask your question, not make a speech. As we get going. So Ben, why don't you go? I'm going to ask one more question and then we'll start.
I think this is super important, which I'm talking about, this provision that suggests that this law does not provide protection for someone who initiates a conflict. The thing is, it is, and I don't know whether it's the case that this provision is being overlooked, but there are a number of cases on the books that where someone who initiated the conflict is in fact protected. The one that comes to mind, let me read this real quick. Here's the section, one paragraph, that deals with standard ground, page 12 of the jury instruction. If George Zimmerman was not engaged in unlawful activity and was attacked at any place where he had a right to be,
He had no duty to retreat and had the right to stand his ground and meet force with force, including deadly force, if he reasonably believed that it was necessary to do so to prevent death or great bodily harm to himself or another, or to prevent the commission of a forcible felony. Here's what the law's author wrote about this law after Trayvon Martin died. Mr. Zimmerman, this is Ben Baxter, Republican from Ocala. Mr. Zimmerman's unnecessary pursuit and confrontation of Trayvon Martin elevated the prospect of a violent episode and does not seem to be an act of self-defense as defined by the Castle Doctrine. There is no protection in the stand your ground law for anyone who pursues and confronts people.
Are you serious?
Here's the thing. This is from a story of mine. I'm quoting Steve Romine, a defense lawyer here in Tampa. That's not what the law says. They might think that in their own heads, but it's just not true. If you're doing something legal, no matter what the act is, and you're attacked, it's in that moment that you have a right to stand your ground. So this case comes to mind. Grayson Garcia is asleep in his apartment in Miami a couple of years ago. His roommate wakes him and says, "Somebody's stealing your stereo." Garcia grabs a kitchen knife, runs downstairs. The thief hears him coming, grabs a bag of radios that he's stolen from other cars on the block, and takes off running down the street. Garcia chases him two blocks. When he finally catches up to him, the thief turns and swings the bag of radios at Garcia's head. Garcia blocks the radios, stabs the thief in the heart, and the guy dies in the street. Is he protected under stand your ground?
He was protected.
No, he's right behind him.
Shouldn't have been.
Chased him down the street would have never happened if he stayed inside. Chased the guy down the street.
Trayvon would be dead if he wasn't committing a crime. Trayvon was
so
not committing.
Does it make a difference to you to know that Grayson Garcia went back to his apartment and fell asleep without calling the police? Does it make a difference to you to know that the next day he sold the car stereos from that the thief had stolen? He was protected from prosecution under standard ground law. Is that right? Depends, I guess, on how you feel about that law. But like that is, in my mind, like one of these cases that jumps out is this big test. You know, is that how we feel? And again, I've just done what I warned people against. I've made like an anecdote out of a really complicated situation. But is that the kind of law that we want? I don't know. In my mind, and Joe and I debated this for a couple of hours last year. In my mind, it has this tendency to sort of devalue human life.
So I'm going to break in. I'm going to let Al talk. I'm going to then let Dr. Collins talk. And then we're going to start.
Thank you so much. A couple points. On this stand your ground law, if a defendant is going to raise this claim, by rule, under the Florida Rules of Criminal Procedure, he has to file a pretrial motion. And so then that's put before the court. So the issue came up because the Zimmerman defense team was talking about stand your ground, maybe raising that as a defense. Now, let's think for a minute. If he raises that motion, and it has to be pretrial under the rule, the judge has to have a hearing and take evidence on it. Now, let's think for a moment. If Zimmerman pursues that, what must happen? He has to testify. So, therefore, remember what we said at the outset, we're here to win, okay? So, let's not do that. Let's see, go through the trial. He has a Fifth Amendment privilege not to testify. See how the case develops. He's already ready to go if he needs to testify. I don't know. I thought there was a rule called hearsay in criminal law or in the law, but I guess when I saw this trial, maybe they got rid of hearsay. I don't know why some of this evidence was introduced. But in any event, that's how it went. Whereas the theory of the case, every attorney goes into a case or should with a theory of the case of how you're going to present it. You want to fence him in to make him what? Get up and testify. Now, a couple people have commented about police arresting people. Those of you who saw the trial itself, audience participation just for a second and I'll be done. How many of you saw the trial by show of hands? You watched it, replays, whatever the case may have been. What did you think of the government's, prosecution's evidence? You thought it was pretty shabby?
Yes.
Now. Okay, awful. It's horrible. Now, and how many people, by show of hands, you were upset that George Zimmerman was not arrested when everything first happened? By show of hands. Now, keep your hands up. From the time, the police officers know the law just like the attorneys know the law. Now, if you thought the evidence was shabby, listen to the rule. Once the police officer makes an arrest on a felony,
Once the arrest takes place, the prosecution has 175 days to bring their case, or you got people like Joe and myself, we're going to be pushing them. So that's the reason why he didn't arrest him, because he got a shabby case. And if a defense attorney, you can put your hands down, once the defense attorney sees you have a shabby case, we're pushing you. Am I right, Joe?
You're right.
How many of you saw this O.J. Simpson case? Zimmerman.
O.J. Zimmerman, oh my God.
He in prison too. But in the O.J. Simpson case, by way of example, the defense attorney, they smelt blood in the water. The case is raggedy. It's weak. We're going to push you now. And guess what you saw going on. So I believe that's the reason they held off on arresting George Zimmerman. That's my theory. Because they need to line their ducks up before you make an arrest. Because the defense attorney is going to push you. And then finally, just remember that when a police officer makes an arrest, I don't care about arrest. Joe doesn't care about arrest. We're concerned with what happens in a court of law. Can sustain a conviction. There's a case called Illinois versus Gates, which simply says the person probably committed the offense. So we don't care about an arrest. On a scale of A to F, D minus is passing. D minus is enough for a person to get arrested. Thank you.
Well, and I just will point out quickly that Bill Lee, the police chief in Sanford, was saying as the family was pressing for an arrest, mm-hmm. but they didn't think they were going to arrest him.
Uh-huh.
So I think that's why people were concerned and felt like the police were never going to arrest him. They didn't seem like they were building a case.
Right.
It seemed like they believed him.
Right, and the prosecutor's not going to try his case in the press. Now, statute of limitations on a misdemeanor, 90 days in the state of Florida. Felony, 175 days. There's a difference in speedy trial, 90 days on a misdemeanor, 175 on a felony, versus statute of limitations. There's no statute of limitation. There's no time limit on prosecuting someone for a homicide. So you got all the time in the world to line your cases up. There's no need to make an arrest right on the spot. So I just want that point, because it's always been circulating throughout this whole process. Arrest, arrest. I don't care about an arrest. I want a conviction.
Sure, sure. But again, you know, Bill sure. did media after the verdict saying that it exonerated his
yes,
position.
Yes, yes, yes.
I don't think he planned to arrest him.
Yeah.
I just wanted to make two quick short comments. One is defend himself. Throughout the trial and the opportunity that I had to listen, it was a consistent that George Zimmerman was defending himself.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, he was standing his ground, and I'm not too sure of the instructions that was given to the jury, because I only heard what the mm-hmm. one individual mm-hmm. said. But when she actually made her comments, it was simply that even though we didn't have the pretrial hearing, mm-hmm. it seemed that they was doing a stand your ground anyway. I wanted to say that. And the other thing I wanted to say about laws, because this is the focus on where the NAACP is coming from. Alex, who actually was able to use Florida,